Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
I'm feeling really connected to my spirit animal.
Which is what, a pig?
No. I think to be a bit clearer, I think I'm feeling quite connected to my fashion spirit animal.
Ah, I see.
Yes, because today's guest has been an inspiration to me for about a decade because I got heavily into
drugs.
Fashion. No, right. Not drugs, babe. I mean, it probably was a kind of drug for a period of time, but definitely not drugs, no. But I got heavily into fashion when I was in my late 20s, and I used to love buying very extreme like prints and brightly colored clothes. And every time I would go out, people always used to say to me, oh my God, do you know Tim Blanks? Tim Blanks would love what you're wearing. And I think he's got the same shirt. So I started Googling this guy, Tim Blanks, and started to see that we literally owned all the same clothes. So I've always seen him as this kind of
competition
that I'm connected to. No, not competition, actually. I just love him because there was no one else who seemed to wear like brightly colored clothes, and he did, and I loved him. So I eventually got to meet him in the art world, which was amazing, through Studio Voltaire, and he loves art a lot. And he was somebody that I really wanted to talk to on Talk Art, and so did you. So I'm really excited about today.
Yeah,
I'm glad that quarantine has brought us all together.
Yes, the lockdown. Well, welcome to Talk Art.
Tim Blanks.
Hi, Tim. How are you doing?
I'm good after that introduction. I'm excited too.
yes. How are you? So how are you filling your days at the moment? What's happening for Tim Blanks?
I have work to do, which is good. I have actually just being incredibly still. We have a routine. We do the morning shop, we do the morning walk, and then have lunch, and I watch television and read and watch more television and do more reading, and that's it. Mm-hmm. I don't know
it's
how long
good
it
you've
can
got
go
work.
On for. Yeah, yeah. yeah. And work
that's
interesting.
Good.
So, yeah,
that's good. And you got the routine. That's the thing to do. Isn't
yes,
it, I guess.
Yes. Yeah. The only thing I'm not very good at is the physical fitness. But my brother said to me that people are going to come out of this either being excellent cooks or alcoholics, and either way, you're going to be fat.
Happy. So you're going to be fat either way. Yeah, that's true. That's true. I mean, I'm literally just like snacking at the fridge every like half an hour, like mince over there, crack it open, see what's going on, come back.
I'm meant to be trying to do yoga, but...
Oh, I can't. I think I'm hypermobile. I don't think I can do yoga. It's my excuse. I'm making a ratatouille even as we speak, actually.
Oh, gosh. Well done.
It keeps well.
Yeah, good. You freeze that.
We were baking last night with our friends. Russell watched us do it. What were we on? We were on House Party, this app. He didn't have the ingredients, but our group of friends, about seven of us, were all baking cakes. Not cakes, cookies. And mine literally came out like cardboard cakes. They're the worst thing I've ever tasted. And it was the first time I've ever baked. And I'm officially a terrible baker. But it was...
Well, it's your first attempt. It's fine.
That's true.
It's fine. I think baking is very ambitious.
It is. Tim, people would know you as a fashion critic. Would you say that was the right thing? That overall, if anyone mentioned your name, they'd know you as someone who has been there for many years, watching all the best fashion shows around the world and critiquing them.
Yes, I guess that's fair. I've always been a bit anxious about the word critic. I prefer writer, I suppose, because I write about fashion from my own point of view, and if sometimes it gets critical, I guess. Yeah, I guess I do critique things, but I consider myself more a sort of amateur and enthusiast than a critic. So,
that's good. Like a fan, a fanboy.
Yeah, a fan, a real fan. I'm a huge fan of fashion. I always felt I was a little bit outside that world, and I was, you know, outside looking in. And I think that was a good perspective to have on it for as long as I've been doing it, decades. So I never, yeah, kept me sane.
You're from New Zealand, so I guess you're saying you're from the outside. I mean, how much of growing up in New Zealand did fashion make its way over to you there?
Not at all. Not the very first thing that had any suggestion of Paris about it was when our local department store, which was called Smith & Coe's, got Yves Saint Laurent ties for men. And, you know, when you saw the Yves Saint Laurent label, Paris, you know, that was like that obelisk in 2001. Yeah, you would touch it and you'd feel a shiver of otherness then. But no, there was no, absolutely no fashion to speak of. You know, locally, I've always had this theory about people who grew up in satellite countries, you know, that they would avidly read about what was happening everywhere else in the world in magazines that took 6 months to get to us. And you'd be reading about things going on at the factory or, you know, at the sombrero or whatever. And then you and your friends would diligently try to recreate those scenes for yourselves using whatever resources you had at hand, and often in attempting to duplicate them. I found that when I finally got to see what all those things were like, we'd often exceeded them, you know, and we'd often done them better than the originals, or so I thought. So
that's very cool.
So you mentioned the factory and the sombrero. What is that? What were those influences on you? Can you explain a little bit more about
what
they were?
Well, the factory was obviously, I mean, Andy Warhol, I think, was the first artist I was ever really aware of. And that was because my grandmother got Life magazine. And he always seemed to be in Life magazine. And I remember there was a very famous, turned out to be very famous, photo story, I guess, with him and Edie Sedgwick doing something. And she was, I don't know who the photographer was. It might have been Bert Stern, actually. And she was standing on a Lalan rhinoceros or something. I think it was that. And those photos, when you're looking, I mean, I was, what, probably 10 or 11? And looking at those photos, you just thought, wow, who are these people? And I became completely obsessed life was the most amazing lifeline to the world. And I mean, all sorts of amazing things that I learned about. But photos like that were really shaped my sensibility when I was a kid.
But the factory was where Andy Warhol's place, wasn't it?
In New York.
What was the sombrero?
The sombrero was a gay disco in Kensington, and it was where all the people that I was obsessed with, after I was obsessed with Andy Warhol, I got obsessed with, you know, Mark Bolan and the Velvet Underground and David Bowie, and the sombrero seemed to be the kind of place where they would all end up. And it was kind of funny, when I finally did come to London, when I finally made it to London, I really felt that I had seen God one night when I was at the sombrero and Angie Bowie was dancing with a protege of Bowie's called Dana Gillespie. And they were having a good old gals workout on the dance floor together. And I thought, wow, you know, one of those moments where you think, I've arrived.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, you if you don't aim high, you'll always be happy.
And what was your experience of art growing up in New Zealand? Did you study art or learn about art?
I actually did go to art college, believe it or not. For I
in
did
New
a,
Zealand?
I did a Yeah, I did. I went to Elam Art School, which was affiliated with the university. I did one year when I was doing, I did English and German and political studies, and I needed something a little more
creative.
What would you call it? A little more
creative.
So I did a course in art history, and that again, I distinguished myself by stealing their copies of Interview from the library, from the university library, which is I still have them, and I still feel I should.
The ones you stole.
Yeah, I feel I should return them. 1970, when would that have been? 1972, I guess. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's terrible. I was such a thief. but no, I mean, art. What would have? Yeah, Warhol. I was really obsessed with music, and art as it pertain to music. I mean, Bowie did a song about Andy Warhol. Well, you know, you could feel it all coming together in one great big ball. But
the Velvet Underground album cover that Warhol did with the banana sticker on. Did you ever get access to that?
I had that. I had the original. I had the first release of that album with a, and somebody bloody well peeled the banana off one day.
Oh,
and
no.
I was so, and then they said, oh, sorry. And they tried to stick it back on like it was all, torn, and you know, and so I got the anyway, that was a reason to end that friendship, but
that's a good reason, but
Warhol, and then the movies, obviously. I was obsessed with movies, so you know, there was that moment where everything was moving together, where art and music and movies, so you'd go to
fashion,
and fashion too, yeah, which kind of, you know, when you saw Blow Up, when you saw a movie like Blow Up. Or all sorts of strange movies where, like, or even something crazy like Smashing Time with Lynn Redgrave and Rita Tushingham. You would be looking at movies and seeing the London art world or whatever, and it all looked so impossibly fabulous from the other side of the world. It was hard to resist.
Magazines seem like a massive. Have had a massive effect on your life and access to the world that you then projected yourself into. You're saying, like, your granny's Time magazine and then finding Interview magazine. That's been such a resource for you. Do you still find magazines like something that you look to as a resource and as inspiring and as important?
No. Oh. There are magazines that I love, which I discover new magazines all the time, but I mean, I was a serious magazine addict. It was like a sickness. When I left New Zealand the first time to travel across the world, 1974, I think it was, I had three suitcases, and one of them was full of magazines.
It was
ridiculous. I was just the most stupid. But I couldn't leave them. They were like my children, and
yeah.
I still have them all. It's monstrous. I mean, my husband Jeff he has nightmares that the room they're all in is going to spontaneously combust and burn us into the ground because
oh my God.
There is just all this really old paper kind of drying,
how many have you got,
wrinkling. Oh, millions. I mean, you know, Idea Books and Dover Street Market. I think one day. You know, my horror is that when I die, they'll all just be skipped. These things that have traveled the world with me and that I've nurtured for years will just be skipped. And I have
to donate them to someone, basically. Yeah.
I try.
It sounds like a V&A exhibition. It should be like a Tim Blanks magazines show. I would love.
You know,
that.
I had like a decade of French Vogues. I had the entire 1980s in French Vogue, actually. And I tried to give them to the. I lived in Toronto for 12 years, and I tried to give them to the local fashion college, and they said to me, "Well, no, you'll have to bring them to us. We can't get them. We can't come pick them up." And I said, "This is a truckload of stuff. Seriously, I'm not going to rent a truck to drop." So I just piled them all out on the street, and I went for a walk with the dogs, when I came home, there was a truckload filled with Japanese fashion students who were loading them all into the back of the van. So they went to a good home. I could be happy.
Oh, good,
about
good.
That.
I thought you meant they were just going to, people just picked them up off the street. No, they did actually go somewhere.
There must have been a Bush telegraph that just let the you know, pile of French Vogues outside such and such a place.
And that's a type of collection as well then for you. So you were like, you know, obsessively collecting these magazines. I mean, I remember collecting records as well and like CDs and taking them around
too.
with me on travels. I would have like a whole like hand luggage full of plastic CD cases and CDs. You know, it's like crazy, isn't it? When you think about the weight of stuff you're carrying around with you. But so yeah, you obviously have a kind of collecting bug for it.
Yeah, a kind of hoarding mentality. Yeah.
Are you like that with fashion?
No.
Do you don't hang on to clothes and stuff like you're not that as
I don't throw stuff out as much as I should, and I mean my problem is that my shape changes like, you know, like the doughboy. So I did have a period where I got quite a lot skinnier than I am. And I did kind of get into clothes for a while, and I had shirts made and things, and now they're just like, dear, I mean, there's just a mountain of them that we'll dispose of at some point. I do quite like coming back to sort of stretchy things and generous things, and Japanese designers are extremely timeless in that respect, actually. So,
Kanzai Yamamoto and Comme des Garçons were your kind of first Japanese fashion loves, right?
Yeah, probably. And Yoji, yeah, probably. Yeah, Yoji Kanzai Yamamoto, books of Bowie. Yes. You know, I think David Bowie was an education for all his fans. I mean, anything he read, I would read. Anything he wore, I would make an effort to not wear, but find so I could look at it. Anything you listen to, I would listen to. You know, I don't know if there are people like that in pop culture anymore who have that kind of hold over their audience. But you know,
do you think
I remember he was aware of
that?
Yeah, I saw an interview with him once where he was talking about Colin Wilson, how much he loved Colin Wilson's writing, and he said he felt like Colin Wilson was a medium between really arcane ideas and a mass audience. And he said that I feel I'm a medium as well. I feel that even just him sitting there telling his audience about Colin Wilson, he was passing on. Yeah, he was quite diligent about passing on all the things that were influencing him. I know that made him seem incredibly pretentious to people who didn't like him particularly, but I always found it really inspiring, actually.
So it's like that Bowie received wisdom, just went beyond.
Yes. Yes.
Wow. I heard you say before as well that Bowie, because he was constantly and very quickly moving from one look to another, that kind of got you your mind ticking in a sense of what fashion could be, or you know, this idea of fashion being the new and the next.
Yeah, well, he was kind of, if you think about, that was during the 70s when he was really moving so quick, cycling so quickly through all those looks. And what was fashion? And, you know, fashion in the 70s didn't really, I mean, there wasn't that sort of ready-to-wear thing that we talk about now. It was haute couture, and then it was clothes. And I never thought of David Bowie as fashion particularly because, you know, he had clothes made for him by people like Kanzai Yamamoto, but they were costumes for a persona. So... Right. I always sort of him as a perform as a you know he was more about performance than sort of fashion, and then later on what he wore became part of the iconography of fashion when you know fashion sort of boomed in the 80s and the 90s, and then it started to look back and process things as a fashion influence. I mean, I think the 90s in fashion, you know, people talk about the 70s being the definitive decade in movie making. I think the 90s was such a definitive decade in the history of fashion, so that it when it really became this gigantic umbrella for so many different creative endeavors, that fashion embraced more things than any other medium did. And
do you think that went hand in hand with like the YBA movement, the Young British Artists movement, and Britpop,
fashion
at the same time?
Definitely, definitely. And everything that was happening in music, like everything that was happening in music and movies, I felt that fashion kind of was in a way bigger than all of them, that fashion took more from everything else to make these incredible hybrids, and then actually fed them back into, you know, now art, now you can see how influenced by the art world, by the fashion world, that art, the art world is. And I think that's really that's really a testament to the incredible power that fashion took on in over the course of the 90s, with a, you know, that incredible cast of characters that everybody was so mesmerized by.
Do you follow any fashion photographers? Do you
look
to?
Yes. Oh, yes, absolutely.
So who are your, like, who are your fashion photographer heroes, and who now do you think is doing really exciting work?
The two people who have actually made me look at magazines again with the kind of enthusiasm that I looked at them when I was a teenager, Jack Davison, the photographer, and Ib Kamara, the stylist. Ib works with people like Paolo Reversi, more of the sort of old school people. He also works with Jack. And the way they look at things, I mean, Jack, I think Jack Davison is such a genius. He really is.
How old is he?
He's young. I don't know how old he is. I get the feeling he's extremely young. But his photos have that incredible, when you're looking at them, you feel that charge that you felt looking at Munkaji or Man Ray or the people from
the 20s and 20s.
He will be, yeah. If the world gives him a chance, he will be one of the greats for sure. And Ib is just a fantastic stylist and with a vision, a really poetic vision. I think that they're wonderful. Both of them are wonderful storytellers.
And when did they both start to come through? Like, when did you first discover them? Like, recently?
Yeah, a couple of years, I would say. Amazing. The last couple of years. I don't think Jack ever. I don't know him. I mean, I don't know him very well. I don't. I've never actually met him. We've talked on Instagram, but I get the feeling that he never considered himself a fashion photographer. He maybe resists. He's not a fashion photographer, but he does a lot of work within fashion. And I get the feeling
he's an artist, right?
I wonder what he'd call himself. I wonder. Mm. He'd be a good person to have on Talk Art,
that's
actually.
Good note,
yeah, I'm just
like the fact that you mentioned
now.
A stylist.
Amazing.
I like the fact you mentioned a stylist, because it feels like, are they the unsung heroes of the fashion industry?
I'm very much about singing the songs of the unsung heroes. I've always been in all the time I've covered fashion shows, I've always made a point of talking about the hair, the makeup, the stylist, the person who does the music. That's one thing. When I've written about fashion, I've written about fashion shows most of the time, and I feel that if that's what a designer wants you to see of their work, then that's what I will write about. Because people say, well, you'd go and do Reese's in a showroom or what? And I know, because the show is the thing, which means we're in a very interesting spot right now with the way the fashion world is going to change after COVID-19.
What do you think is going to happen?
You know, being confronted with the excess of things, which this virus is making people do, the fashion world is excessive, and fashion shows are a particularly excessive expression of fashion excess. The way they soak up resources, the way they involve so much travel, that suddenly seems kind of, I don't know, seems outmoded. And yet the fashion show is such an essential part of the fashion industry in terms of storytelling and content generation or whatever. This is going to be a huge challenge to see how people reconcile this change in sensibility with the way that things have always been done. I love fashion shows, and I'd be very, very sad to see them disappear, but I do accept that there needs to be another,
these discussions obviously happening now amongst all your peers and...
Yeah, yeah.
And it's also
and in the art world.
Historical.
Yeah, totally. Yes, in the art world as well, totally. With art fairs and shipping and all of these crazy things. Yeah, yeah, it's all just, I mean, there's big discussions going on right now on WhatsApp. We have a big group of gallerists all talking about it. And it's like, you know, how comfortable do we all feel about, you know, continuing to do what we're doing to the world? I mean, it's just, it's crazy. And also climate change and has also affected for the conversation for the last kind of decade almost in a way, or at least 5 years, in fashion as well, because people trying to use different materials. If you think of like Christopher Rayburn, is that his name?
Yes.
I always remember him using like, you know, old parachutes and stuff, and things like that. And a lot of the younger generation at that time were really starting to try and bring in different materials that were a bit more either sustainable or, and you know, so on. But
well, you know, sustainability, circularity, inclusivity, diversity. I mean, the fashion industry has been called to account on so many different fronts in the last couple of years. But it is the second most wasteful industry in the world. Its impact on the environment is has just been so, you know, so incalculable for so many years, and also human rights issues and all these things. I just now we're having to address them. I don't see. I mean, I've for a long time I've been saying that I could see fashion becoming a dressmaker, a tailor, and a cobbler in your local community. You know, the way it used to be.
I could, and
you know, the another word that's coming out more and more is localization, and in the industry that you actually, this is something that obviously people are going to be looking at a lot more after this, when this virus crisis passes, if it passes, the ways to sustain a business and localization is a way to sustain a business. You work with people locally. You are not traveling around the world to save 25 cents by having something made in Madagascar, you know. You're actually, but then you have to re-educate people that that the price of something reflects its value, and it's, and you need to re-educate people about the whole idea of preciousness. I think that you don't buy something at, you know, a bathing suit for a pound. Remember that there was that story that he was selling bathing suits for a pound. I mean,
Primark or something, was it?
Or Primark, somebody, you're going to wear that once, and then you're not exactly going to cherish it and pass it on to your kids, are you? And I think that that is why that's an interesting debate in fashion. I would like to see that change happen. It's something Karl Lagerfeld always used to say. He was a big proponent of buy less, buy better. And you know, the whole idea of haute couture is actually extremely sustainable, because it's an absolutely human craft which is based on the durability and sustainability of the product it makes. And you know, you pass it on. You don't dispose of haute couture. It doesn't get chucked out. Keep it, and you have a relationship with the person who designed it and made it for you. And I can see all of that having hopefully having a long-term impact on the way fashion operates.
And actually,
but I am an idealist.
Actually, I was thinking a lot about, I heard a conversation you had, I don't even know when it was, maybe it was 6 months ago or something, with Kim Jones. And I remember listening to it, because you obviously do a podcast yourself with Business of Fashion, which is available on podcast platforms. And I remember traveling somewhere and listening to your interview with Kim, and him talking about, you know, how in a way haute couture is sustainable. But also what I love about Kim is the way that he has, you know, worked with artists so directly to make such incredible items of clothing, which are artworks in their own right. And I think when art and fashion meet like that, it's just such a powerful thing. How do you feel about art and fashion like being linked, and when is it right and when does it not work? Or
I feel it's right when it's authentic. I mean,
yeah,
I feel it's right when there's when you know that there's a relationship between the designer and the artist. I think you know, Raf Simons, when he worked with Sterling Ruby, it was so real, because you could imagine that even if they didn't make anything to sell to other people, that's what they would love to be doing themselves anyway. Kim is a perfect example of somebody who understands the notion of preciousness and everything from the tiniest little thing he designs to the whatever, the grand coat or cape or whatever, is just filled with this idea of craft and ingenuity and imagination. And I think that this season was very interesting, the one we just finished, because there was quite a lot of collaborative stuff between designers and artists. Maria Grazia Curie at Dior with her evolving feminist manifesto in fashion. Yes. She worked with Judy Chicago. And then this season she worked with...
It was a collective, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. You're right. Yes, good. Thank God you've got a spry young mind, because mine is a bit atrophied. She did that, and then there was Alessandro Sartori at Xenia. I had an installation made with another female artist from... it was a great season for women artists, but I do think that that's a conscious... You know, that is a conscious attempt to redress a situation which...
Yeah, definitely. Mm. There's someone that I keep noticing is Grace Wells Bonner as well, because I think the way that she kind of involves and brings together like the worlds of like kind of literary worlds, but also very much art worlds, you know, like she often will post things on her Instagram to do with paintings by Frank Bowling or by different artists. I really love the way that she creates some kind of connection between different creative spheres and worlds.
Yeah, and when I talk about Ib Kamara, I would put him in that, in her. I think of all those people as being like a kind of new wave of young creative people, in not just in fashion, but just generally that there's a sort of... I think London has always done community and fashion extremely well, much better than any other city, that designers hang out with each other and help each other and so on. And I think that I feel that's spreading again now, but reaching out into other areas, so that you get writers as what involved as well. You have and then Grace and Craig Green and all these people who
we love Craig. I also really like Nicholas Daly. I wear a lot of his clothes, and I think he as well will bring in like musical influences in, you know, and also like subculture kind of styles from music that then, you know, from the past that will then influence, you know, the way that he's doing now. But again, with art as well, I think he's brilliant.
I think that is a wonderful thing about British culture, like, well, youth culture, whatever you want to call it, but you know, the whole notion of the cults that have driven pop culture in the UK, everybody seems so much more open-minded, and they don't seem so driven by the demon dollar. You know, when you're talking to people and young designers in other cities, the notion of what constitutes success is slightly different from what you hear when you're talking to designers at St. Martin's or wherever that, and you know, maybe the only other place I ever really came across that was Antwerp, where it was just the joy of making things, and it wasn't so much about, oh, we're going to be a $1 billion business by the end of next year, you know.
That's still the case in Antwerp now with the art scene, because there's so many young and also older artists, and they're all totally connected in Antwerp in a way that I never really see anywhere else. Like it's a very unique place to be.
But that's where Dries Van Noten's from, isn't it? And yes, Mulister and Raf Simons is from there, is he?
Raf Simons and Walter van Beerendonk. And you know, a couple of Arne and Philippe van der Voorst, who are wonderful designers from Antwerp, they did something really striking this season where they just closed their business and they said goodbye. And they sold their archives to museums and private collectors and so on, but they had a very conscious closing event, saying goodbye to their years in fashion. And I thought it was so elegant and so smart that they control their own story. They didn't just fade away, you know, somebody in 3 years saying, what happened to those two from Antwerp?
Right,
you know,
right.
They actually said this wonderful, complete goodbye. And that seems to me like a very Antwerp thing, because, you know, Anne de Moulemeester did it and Martin Magella did it, that
yes.
they they left. They said, "This is us leaving, you know, goodbye." And I have a horrible feeling we might be seeing a lot more people doing that in the next little while, because I think fashion is so stressed by, is going to be so stressed by the situation that we're in right now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Arts, the arts podcast, and we're here today with Budweiser beer, and we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and it's really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also giving people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and Talk Art with Sir Peter Blake.
So somebody who I really love, who I think somehow has managed to sort of function on the the kind of outside of the art world while still being incredibly influential in the art world was a later Antwerp designer, Bernard Wilhelm, because I think he's someone who brings in so many like art references, you know, even to the point where he'll have like a painting actually on one of his, sweatshirts or something. But I love his actual like shoots, when you have the collection shot as a photography set of photographs, the way he'll do like 60 photographs or something and they become this amazing kind of artistic story. I think he's
brilliant. On a porn star. I think
exactly,
that
exactly. It's so genius.
He is fashion's great Dadaist, I think.
Oh, he's just the best.
Yeah. Yeah. He's so funny. He makes me so nervous.
Really?
Does he?
He does make me nervous because I think he delights in making me nervous. So which I like. I like somebody who's
unsettling, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, I love that. I love.
He came to stay at my house in Margate when I first moved here, and it was like still a bit of a building site. And I don't think he was quite prepared for the amount of dust that was going to be around. It was actually really really funny, but we had the most wonderful time. And the thing that I took from him was I think he gets a lot of his inspiration from nature and flowers, and he seems to have he tends like a rose garden in his place in Paris, and he's super into nature. It really struck me spending sort of proper time with him. How that was like a big source of what he looks at. And I think he shares that with Andreas as well, Vivian Westwood's husband and partner. But they seem to have this kind of love of nature, which affinity, I don't think a lot of younger people necessarily always think about either.
They're gonna now. We are now, God.
Yes.
We all just want to be outside in nature suddenly. There was actually a funny thing come up that the whole year they're trying to get people outside to exercise and everyone's like, no thanks. And suddenly it's like they said, you can't go outside, and everyone's suddenly doing like the Duke of Edinburgh Award, trying to get outside as much as possible. Tony said that.
What did Joni say? You don't know what you've got till it's gone,
Don't it always seem to go, So as a fashion journalist, do you find it... like when you look at other things in life, for art, for example, do you look at that with a journalistic eye now that you kind of take it on, or you're able to look at it objectively?
Oh my God. I look at art in a completely visceral way. It's that old thing. I know what I like, I know what I respond to. I know what gives me a surge, like when I'm listening to music, when I heard, have you heard the Blank Mass soundtrack for Calm with Horses?
Nope.
You know, the new movie Calm with Horses, that's just the British indie movie that's just about to come out. And I noticed there was a bubble of press and then everything got closed down. But this guy called Blank Mass did the soundtrack. And when you hear, and the soundtrack of Atlantics, that Senegalese movie is incredible too. And it's when you, Fatima Al-Khadiri, that's the name of that woman, when you hear a piece of music and you just respond to it completely irrationally, you're just like, wow, that's kind of like looking at pictures that I know you mentioned Lisa Bryce recently on the podcast.
Yes.
That the little picture that she did for Voltaire Christmas shop was so, the minute you saw it, I was like, my God. The reaction is.
Did you get one?
Oh,
so
yes,
did we.
I did.
So we all share an artwork.
To be there when... But they sold out
3 minutes
really
or something.
She's incredibly popular. Yeah.
Yeah.
Who else do you look at then, Tim? Who gives you these jolts?
Well, I know you're talking to Jordan Castile, that exhibition she has at the New Museum at the moment. Those pictures are incredible. I love Kevin Beasley's work. The depth of what he does. I love it when it's really super, super deep, but it's also immediately kind of beautiful. Yeah. That makes me feel good. Oh, well, that's really beautiful. I can like that. But, I also understand that there's something else going on behind it, That makes me feel smart.
It's and layered and nuanced.
Like
that.
How
do you know Jordan Castile's work?
She's with the gallery in New York called Casey Kaplan, and he's my oldest friend in New York. And actually, he has been, when I think about it, I don't know if you do this, but you have a relationship with a gallerist and they kind of lead you through their evolution. They and you find yourself, you're learning about things as they learn about things, and and you're buying things from them as they discover new artists. I've bought a lot of stuff from Casey over the years, and I obviously he's incredibly good with building his artist careers, and he and a guy like I who trundles in with my piggy bank and wants to get something I don't get the access to the pieces that are going to institutions and, you know, fabulous private collections like Jordan, but it is an education.
But that's amazing that you're buying, though, and amazing that you're sticking with their roster. Who have you bought then? Who are you buying and who have you bought? And do you live with all your work?
Yeah, yes, I do. I do. We try to kind of rotate things on the wall. I'm sure you have to do that as well, because there's a lot. I haven't bought anything for a little. I bought is that photographer Gregory Halpin? Crudson. No, Gregory Halpin. No, I used to buy Gregory Crudson pictures a long time ago. And Gregory Halpin, who's a photographer that I really love, I think he's quite old, but he's sort of a bit in the William Eggleston vein. But beautiful work. And if they are photographs of found things, there's always something so surreal about them that they remind you that they're just a nice reminder that truth is always stranger than fiction. And I love his. I actually am going back to photography more.
I've got a feeling. I've got a feeling you collected photography from Counter Editions, even like over the years. Like maybe Jürgen Teller.
Yes. I did.
You've interviewed Jürgen before as well.
Well, I have Jürgen. I have Jürgen Teller. So you know, when I first started buying, I left my job in Toronto, and my leaving present was they asked me to pick a photograph from a local gallery, Jane Corkin, which was incredibly generous. So I picked a horsed photograph of Marlene Dietrich, and that was my going away gift from Toronto in 1990.
So cool.
And I made a friend in London who was very into buying photographs, and because of him, I started going to the photographer's gallery, and then I started buying a lot of photographs from exhibitions there, and Rinneke Dykstra and Jürgen had an exhibition there. And so I got a lot of really, really fabulous pictures then. And then I moved into paintings and floor pieces and so on. Now I'm going back to photographs, I think.
Didn't you nearly buy a Cindy Sherman photograph for $50, but instead you bought a jacket? Oh, God.
I bought a Kanzai Yamamoto coat. I mean, do you know General Idea? Well, when I arrived in Toronto, I never remembered. I kept diaries because I just never did. I didn't think I kept diaries, but I found I did keep a diary when I first went to Toronto. And General Idea were almost the first people that I met. I went to a Halloween concert at a gig at a place called the Horseshoe Tavern to see a band from LA called the Screamers, who were the most amazing unrecorded band in the history of music. They were a punk band who only played synthesizers, and this was in 1978. And so it was like Kraftwerk on sulfate. They were just magnificent. And anyway, I met General Idea that night. And
tell our listeners who General Idea were.
General Idea were three guys from Toronto who created an entire universe of for their work to exist in. Very detailed. They did a magazine called File, which was an obvious kind of piss take on Life, same format. And their work was very ironic, kind of satirical, but extremely beautiful. They made the objects they made as a comment on consumer society or whatever were extremely beautiful. And two of them died, Jorge and Felix died, and A.A. Bronson, as the survivor of the trio, has kind of expanded on their universe. He had a show with Maureen Paley last year, the year before. and a big show in Paris. And their work at the time, because their work was about, it was a lot about surface, but then, you know, as time rolls on, it suddenly is so deep and haunting and sad and
political.
And
a bit, yeah. A lot about AIDS, wasn't it? They'd had one of the most famous pieces eventually, was the AIDS.
Yeah. Because two of them did die of AIDS. So that eventually became like a huge thing in their work where they, you know, they repurposed the love as an AIDS, as a AIDS graphic. And I find their work really, the work really resonates.
I've actually found it's really interesting how, because A.A. Bronson is still a very active artist, he's very active on the internet. And I love the fact that General Idea have like an Instagram account that you can follow. And it's kind of like interacting with their work in a completely different way, because it's less physical, obviously, but you're still getting messages from them and kind of like visual inspiration. I love following that account.
How did you come to Cindy Sherman?
Oh, yes. Oh, that was my Cindy Sherman story, wasn't it? Okay, so, God, I'm so windy.
I'm loving all these tangents. I was in New York.
I am the most tangential individual that you will ever meet. I was in New York with General Idea, and we were going to see a band called Rough Trade, who had, they'd done the record cover for Rough Trade. This is one of those weird situations. Rough Trade were a big deal in Canada, and they were playing at Danceteria in New York, and their support band was REM, which was just, you know, one of those funny twists. REM just arrived from Athens, Georgia. Anyway, somewhere along the way, they knew Cindy Sherman, and we ended up looking at Cindy Sherman's at pictures. They were really fabulous, those film stills, when those untitled film stills, looking at them as, and they looked like film stills, and I loved them, but I could swear, although this seems apocryphal, but I could swear that they were $50. And instead of buying them, I went to the Kansai boutique and I bought a bumblebee yellow corduroy coat. And I remember vividly my credit card was refused while I was trying to buy it. And Sylvia Miles, remember the actress Sylvia Miles? She was in Heat. She was in Warhol's Heat.
Yes,
she was the older woman in Warhol's Heat.
Really brassy, blonde,
mouthy. She was behind me in the queue and she kicked off that my credit card had been refused. It was a sign. I should have gone back and bought this in
It was the art gods telling you not to do it.
Have you ever met her? Have you ever told her that story?
No, I haven't. I've stood next to her in a sort of tongue-tied kind of awe, but no, I've never told her that story.
You must have met a lot of artists, though, and a lot of photographers.
I met Warhol.
So what?
Yeah,
he was
lovely.
What happened there?
Oh, he's very talky. I liked him a lot. He was very
Where
chatty.
Where did you meet him?
Yeah, I met him in Toronto. When he came up with his book, Exposures, and... he was very nice. I had friends in New York who were young people in New York who were he sort of took under his wing, and everybody said he was just not what you'd ever read about or heard about. You know, he wasn't he was that person as a persona, but there was a lot more to him, and I found him quite charming. And again, it was hard to speak that I was standing in front of Andy Warhol, but.
There's something I really wanted to chat to you about quickly, which was I always remember I went to a Dior one of their fashion shows, and it was in Blenheim Palace or somewhere, and it was all very fancy, insane kind of day. And we came back to London in the evening. There was an illustrator who was doing live drawings. His name's Klim Evenden. And what about illustration in art? If you think of like Howard Tangi and like Julie Verhoeven and those kind of illustrators who end up working with fashion, but they're also artists. Like, is that something that you think about a lot, like when it comes to fashion?
I think illustration, given that the history of fashion is a lot of it is told by incredible illustrators, that it seems like something that went fallow a little bit, the art of illustration. You know, you wonder now if people aren't going to be traveling across the world to do fashion shoots, taking 12 models or whatever and bags of clothes to some far-off land for a couple of days. You could almost imagine that maybe illustration would be something that people would explore Because if you look back to a time when magazines like Anna Piaggi's Vanity were going in Italy, or even GQ, in the American GQ in the 70s, the way they used people like Antonio Lopez as illustrators, and then René Gruau, and the incredible, I mean, the guy who did all of Dior's illustrations in the 30s and the 40s, and Erte, and you know, the famous people, and then right up to now, somebody like Julie doing her work, but Mats Gustafsson, who illustrates for Dior now, but also, I mean, I think Mats Gustafsson is a magnificent artist. His watercolors are the most beautiful things, just about the most beautiful things I've ever seen. And I think it's a, I don't think it's an unsung part of fashion, the role of illustration, but I think it's an underused thing now. You know, there is the Fashion Illustration Gallery in London that is a permanent reminder of how much work is being done in fashion illustration.
Where is that?
I think it was on Cork Street for a while. I don't know where it is now. I really should back up my endorsements with a little more solid.
It's all right. We can post it to our Instagram. We were just chatting the other day to Rufus Wainwright, and he's just made illustrations of his own that he's made into a music video. So I do feel like there's this new sense of ways of doing things, you know, not only for lower budgets, with, you know, with just as much impact, but I think going back to the hand as well. And I was thinking a lot about Yves Saint Laurent's drawings, you know, all those kind of, not just the erotic ones, but just him generally as a draftsman and a drawer. He was amazing.
I was
thinking of that as well. What for you makes work successful? What fundamentally do you look for, and for you think that's hit all the buttons?
When I'm looking, I like figurative work. I'm not like abstracts and conceptual stuff. If I don't know the artist, I mean, somebody like Trisha Donnelly, she's such an amazing woman that knowing her, I would invest a lot of time in trying to understand what it is she's trying to tell me with her art. But generally, if like, look, Jordan is a very good example. You want to know the people in the pictures. You want to know the story. Then you want to know the storyteller. And that's how I relate to things. When when something is visually loaded, then I'm the same with fashion. When I see things which are telling me an incredible story, even if it's completely not what the designer had in mind, which happens an awful lot with me, I'm very taken by that. You know, I guess I'm quite old-fashioned in that respect.
So we ask every guest that comes on two very important questions, but we've also added in a Brucey bonus third question because we're all in lockdown. But the first question we ask is, if you could do an art heist, if you could have any work of art in the world to yourself, what would it be and why?
It would be the Gerhard Richter Baader-Meinhof work.
Wow, really?
Because I would want to... I love getting up really close to his things and looking at how he does stuff, because the surface of them is just a complete and utter... it's mesmerizing. But also that combination of outrage and distance and... East German kind of didacticism or whatever, and then just the sheer physical beauty of that work. I would
what does
want
it
to
look
be
like surrounded. What exactly is it?
You know that the black that where he repurposes photographic images and and does them. Sometimes they're hyper real. They look like photographs, but these are a slightly abstracted news photographs of the Baader-Meinhof gang, the prison cells that they allegedly committed suicide in. You know, it's the whole story. And
who are they? Who are the Baader-Meinhof gang?
The Baader-Meinhof gang were I suppose, urban terrorists. You had the Red Brigades in Italy. You had Baader-Meinhof in Germany. And, you know, driven by, fired up by the Vietnam War and American imperialism, and you know, in the not like the Black Panthers, but at the same time as the Black Panthers, when there was that you know, a surge of activism around the world of people taking up violence as a response when protests became quite toxic,
aggressive,
and they weren't the Baader-Meinhof gang, which is what kind of appealed to me with my slightly, you know, I was drawn to the story because Andreas Baader was a kind of charismatic petty criminal, and Ulrike Meinhof was a university lecturer, an intellectual. You know, she was the philosophy, and he was basically the muscle, I suppose. But the story of her falling under his spell and the whole the tragedy of that story and in every way, the sort of you know, the misguided idealism, the way it just went so hideously wrong, the way it was manipulated by the state, everything about that story is you know, nobody comes out of it looking good, but that's all in the Richter work, you know, it's so oppressive, but it's so weird and kind of not I wouldn't say erotic, but it has that sort of doominess of death cults, which appeals to me.
I actually have a work in the house here by Rebecca Warren, the sculptor, and she makes these collages out of found objects, either from the streets around her studio or even like dust from the studio floor, things like that. And I've got a portrait of Ulrike, I think it's Ulrike, or at least one of the Baader-Meinhof gang, the sort of abstract portrait. So it's actually a topic that's inspired quite a few artists.
What the MDF one you have at home?
The title of it is the name. I think it's Ulrike. I can't quite remember right now. But it's the title is the name of one of the women anyway in the group.
They called themselves RAF,
right,
didn't they?
Red Army Faction. Exactly, yes.
And then there was the Red Brigades in Italy, that, you know, obviously they were motivated by Marxists, which Meinhof and the, you know, it was that weird split between the philosophers and the action men in the gang, and they're permanently at each other's throats, I guess. But
so the other question we ask every guest is very simple. What is your favorite color?
Orange.
That's Rob's.
That's hilarious.
Hermes
really?
Orange. I love orange.
Hermes orange. Good. The boxes.
Yeah. But that is my favorite orange. It is my actually. It's interesting talking to you on this thing, whatever this thing is called. What is this thing called? Lin. What's it?
Lin phone.
That I'm talking to you on. Yeah, they're phone. The bands on their the Lin phone. The banding on their site is Hermes orange, I just noticed, and their little record button is Hermes orange. No, I love orange. You know, you said at the beginning that I wear colors. I love color. I mean I have always loved color. Orange is my favorite.
Whenever I wear orange
color.
I always feel so invigorated.
Have you got the boxes in the house?
Yes. I remember I saw a photo in somebody's interior, an interior magazine of somebody's flat, and they had hundreds of these boxes stacked up. It was like a studio flat, and they just had the boxes were their decoration of their apartment. And I just thought, wow, one day. And never happened. But
the last question we're asking everyone during lockdown is, what is your hidden lockdown talent? What have you discovered while you've been in quarantine that you might not have known you could do before?
Sing.
Really?
Go on. Yeah.
Why? Have you been singing to yourself?
And you know those funny little stickers iPhone, those little, you get the dinosaur and the robot and the alien and the, you know, there's
a lot of emojis,
emojis, and you can make them sing. So I've been making singing emojis. Really?
What are you singing?
Can we have one for the site? We want what? Yeah, what are you singing into them?
I said I had the shark. I had singing "Smells Like Teen Spirit," which is my favorite one.
It makes sense.
I had the giraffe saying "Can't Get You Out of My Head." The dinosaurs saying "Candy Says" by the Velvet Underground.
Can we have
fun.
A sample of your singing now? Would you sing us something for Talk Up?
Candy says, I've come to hate my body and all that it requires in this world.
Wow. Yes, please.
More?
That was beautiful.
That was nice. Yes.
Candy always. Says, I want to know completely what others so discreetly talk about. I'm gonna watch the bluebirds fly over my shoulder. I'm gonna watch them pass me by. Maybe when I'm older, what do you think I'd see if I could walk away from me?
Oh,
and that's about as high as I can
that.
Go.
I want you to put a record out.
So who's that by? What is it?
That is Candy Set. That is Candy Says by the Velvet Underground.
Tim Blank sings the greats.
And it's about Candy, darling.
I mean, that is an album for Christmas, seriously. That's the album we all want.
Candy Says by the Velvet Underground. I'm listening to that as soon as we get off of this phone.
I've also got...
Oh, my God. What an exclusive.
I've also got Marc Jacobs in my head now because of the whole grunge collection he did years and years and years ago, which I always loved. And then
oh, yeah.
I think it was quite sort of... People weren't that happy about it at the time, were they? Yeah.
Well, he lost his job over that. Yeah, that was amazing. That was, when
Why?
Fashion.
Why did he lose his job?
Because he did that collection for Perry Ellis, and it wasn't exactly what Perry Ellis was expecting to, it wasn't ahead of its time. It was just so of its time. And, but its time wasn't Perry Ellis's time. So, I love it. I love it when, I love those moments when fashion and, the zeitgeist collides so completely. That's so thrilling when that happens.
Yeah, and it's such a rare thing, isn't it? And when it does happen,
amazing.
It's... Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, yeah, it is. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Tim. It's been such a joy.
Well, have you got one example of that? Before we say that, have you got an example when that happens?
Yeah,
a recent
example, I think Craig Green's collections managed to do that just about every single time. He doesn't do it deliberately. It's just obviously it's the genius is instinctive, but he just there's this one idea that's isolated, the collection that made everybody cry. The models were barefoot, and it was like I thought it was like the Children's Crusade, and it was just so beautiful, and it was so in a moment where the world felt lost. And well, a previous moment when the world felt lost and everybody felt slightly adrift in fashion. And he just brought it right back down to earth with this collection that looked like, angels leading us into a brighter future. And he does that extremely well.
Yeah, I love Craig. I'm a big fan of his.
Wow. Well, thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
It's been wonderful to spend this
hour
with you. Thank
you. Thank
you
so much.
That was such fun.
I feel incredibly positive now from that, which is exactly what we need.
Let's do it in person at some. Yeah, let's do it in person at some point, though.
Of course. Let's go. Once we're out of this, let's all go for a nice dinner somewhere.
Big hugs.
That would be wonderful.
And we can outprint each other with our prints. I'm currently wearing something in honor of you because you were the person that I first ever saw the banana print Prada shirt.
Prada banana.
And I remember seeing a picture of you in some like thing in about 2011 or something, but you walking on the street or something wearing this shirt. And I was just like, that is the shirt for me because A, it echoed kind of Warhol, but it also reminded me of like the Dandy Warhols, the band that I was into in my teenage years when they used to like reference that image of the banana and also loads of other things. But I eventually got the shirt myself. I think mine has flames on it, but I'm currently wearing it in honor of you, which you'll see on Instagram.
Fabulous. Now, do you ever get to New Zealand?
I would love to go.
I've been there. I went and did the History Boys there like 15 years ago.
Okay, when you go back, if you go there, in Auckland, there is a shop called Strangely Normal.
Love that.
And
really?
You will go crazy. If you like print shirts, you will go
Strangely
crazy.
Strangely Normal. Yeah. What a brilliant, yeah. That sounds like a new wrong. Podcast.
Strangely Normal.
Well, for all images we've been talking about on this today's episode, please go to our Instagram page at Toolcart. And Tim, you're on Instagram, aren't you?
Yes, I am. Yeah.
What's your Instagram handle?
Tim Blanks. Good Simple. Tim Blanks.
Well, thank you so much. And we'll be back very soon. And then thanks for listening. Bye.
Okay.
Bye.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye. You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diament and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.